Hi, my name is Fiona. I'm an author and psychologist. I've spent the majority of my career carrying out in-depth psychological profiling, analysing what makes people tick across a whole range of different settings. I absolutely love hearing about people's lives. Every single one is unique, and every single person is fascinating. And now, I'm so excited to be able to share some of these amazing stories with you. Welcome to episode 2 of Dot to Dot, Behind the Person. I often hear about people's core values and passions, which underlie all the decisions they make and the opportunities they pursue. The topic of today's conversation explores how someone's own drive to get others' voices heard has shaped their own career. My guest has a fiery determination for uncovering injustices, inequalities, and empowering women from across all walks of life. Andrea Thompson is currently editor-in-chief of Marie Claire. Andrea and I talk about everything from her encounters with Harvey Weinstein to giving women the motivation to get on with their day. Hi, Andrea. It's great to have you on the podcast today. Tell us a bit about who you are, where you're at, what's going on for you in life at the moment.
Okay, so my name's Andrea Thompson. I've been editor-in-chief at Marie Claire now for 6 months. So it's a really exciting new journey for me. And I'm a journalist by trade. I've been a journalist for 20 years now. I'm also a mum to 2 very young, energetic boys, and I'm currently in lockdown. I'm preparing myself to go for a run after this because doing some exercise every day is really the thing that's keeping me sane at the moment, with 4 of us all in the house all day every day. So I'm finding exercise a really brilliant relief. I live in London, and that's about it.
I mean, it's pretty massive, isn't it? Because it's quite funny when you said I'm preparing to run after this. I thought, yeah, I'm in lockdown with 2 young boys, and I'm preparing to run away. it's quite massive. I've spoken to you a bit over the last 6 months, and it's a huge role that you've undertaken in terms of this iconic brand that's Marie Claire, taking it from print to digital, and you're leading the way for the rest of the globe, aren't you, in terms of Marie Claire as well?
Yes, that's right. I mean, Marie Claire is an international brand, and there are over 20 different Marie Claires around the world. And all of them, like we used to be, are very much led by the print offering. But 6 months ago, we at UK Marie Claire closed the print magazine. So we are now what's known as a digital first brand. So we're all about, you know, our digital offering, our events, our website, our social channels, and our e-commerce. So it's a really exciting new time to be at the helm, in the sense that, you know, more and more people are consuming media online anyway. Being from a newspaper background and a daily background, for me, the most thrilling thing is being able to be truly reactive and to offer readers sort of ever-changing views on stories in real time. I absolutely love print, but working on a monthly, there was always a bit more of a slow turnover in terms of the sort of topics that you could cover. So in terms of the lockdown, it's been brilliant to be reactive on a daily basis, changing to what's happening and the needs of our audience. From kind of well-being at the beginning and reassurance to coping mechanisms as we've gone through the crisis. And now we're sort of 6-7 weeks in, giving people the tools that they need to look to the future and sort of predicting what the next stage will be. Because, you know, I think particularly our audience is obviously predominantly women, and looking at the fallout for women at the moment is a fascinating topic. I mean, the pay gap is expected to widen significantly after lockdown. So it's about preparing our audiences with the tools that they need to thrive in a new world and survive as well. It's going to be extremely challenging when we come out of lockdown.
And so, I think what's great is that you also, as a magazine, I don't know if you still call it that now, it's online, but it's, you provide that reassurance to people because people look to they look to a brand that they recognize and they feel trust, they feel that there's other people like them who are also reading it. And that gives a huge amount of reassurance to people. And I know that the stuff you've done during COVID has been, like you say, so reactive, or I would say responsive, because you've, every week there's been new information which is feeding, like you say, what your audience wants. And that's a massive demand, because I know that it's from the outside for me, because I speak to magazines as an author and a psychologist, and I know there's a huge lead time on other magazines. I know leading up to Christmas, I'm always surprised that the Christmas issues are sort of start working on them September sort of time.
Yeah, even earlier.
That's a massive change. I mean, like you say, it probably feeds your desire to get information out there quickly and to be responsive, but it's also a huge pressure on you and your team to shift from that several months or a couple of months in advance to suddenly being like, actually, we have to change this now. We have to do this tomorrow. We have to do this in the next 24 hours.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the team that I work with were working on the digital side of Marie Claire before we lost the print. So the journalists that I work with are sort of quite nimble and digital journalists. But obviously, as a brand, Marie Claire is very much, you know, that the print was such a huge part. The thing that the real positive about having to produce this sort of daily content is being able to see the reaction from your audience and shift and pivot and change on a daily basis. And that's really liberating. You know, we'll be like, let's just try this one day. Let's do that with Instagram. Let's do this. Let's trial this. Let's try that. Oh, it doesn't work. Let's try something else. And that's something you could never do in print. You had to be very rooted to an idea and establish a franchise and keep it going for 6 months and see, you know, road test it. And even then, you were never really 100% sure on how it was received. You can see very, very quickly how many likes and you get, and you know how many people read what you're doing and the engagement. So in that way, it opens up such an interesting and engaging way of offering content. On the flip side, there's a lot of content we need to produce, and sometimes that can be really challenging. We're quite a small team, you know, it is about sort of having to be to almost predict what's coming and to react very quickly. But, you know, so far it's, you know, particularly with the COVID situation, it's really revealed how exciting you can be with the content and how you can shift around and try different things, which is exactly what we really, really wanted to do.
And what's amazing as well, or for me, what I love is how wedded to and passionate about the core values of the brand you are. So I know an early conversation we had, what strikes me is it's all these changes are happening and you're being responsive and you're adapting to what the world needs and the audience needs, but your core values as a brand remain the same, and you're very passionate about those core values.
Well, yes, I am. I mean, Marie Claire started out sort of 31 years ago, and it was like, really, it was the first genuinely feminist agenda leading magazine. And it was the sort of magazine that combined luxury, fashion and beauty with that feminist agenda. And it was the first magazine to talk about sort of FGM, global warming, climate change, and all of those values are still really at the heart of what we do. And personally, for me, I mean, I've my career has been about investigative journalism, and the reason I went into journalism was about sort of highlighting injustice and creating change. And to be at Marie Claire, a magazine that's always embodied those values, is fantastic. And I think that, you know, sadly, 3 decades on from when we started, some of the things that we've championed, like women's empowerment and equal rights, you know, the need for that content is even stronger now. You know, I mean, it's the need for quality journalism and, you know, journalism that is empowering for women and that champions, you know, that campaigning spirit. The need is greater than ever, really, and more relevant than ever in such a crowded digital space. So I feel very honoured, really, to be at the helm at the moment.
I think that's an interesting point. And that's something I've experienced from my angle, is the crowded digital space, because it is exactly that. And people aren't sure a lot of the time who to listen to. Is it who's followed the most, or is it who's expert? But who is an expert? Because we no longer really understand that. And again, I think something like Marie Claire, the brand, gives an anchor that people can feel confident in, because they know that is still Marie Claire. The values are still what they've always been, and people can trust it, which is difficult to work out, I think, for people. So it's really interesting. You're talking about investigative journalism, and you're talking about what lights your fire, as it were, what sparks you up, what gets you really engaged. And you can hear when you're talking about that, that's something that you're really... is core to who you are. How did you get to where you are today? Where did it start? I mean, what was your journey?
Well, I suppose I come from a family that was always very political. So there was always a lot of politics being talked at the dinner table, and all of my parents' friends were very political. We lived in an area of North London where we were in a community like in Muswell Hill. I grew up originally. Where, you know, there were lots of people who had come, there was a pocket of people who had come from South Africa who were mixed race couples who had escaped apartheid. And at the time, we often had people living in our house for so often it were like people came and lived in our house for a little bit while they were finding their feet. So we had one of those houses that was really in and out, and lots of different strange smells and things coming from the kitchen with whoever was living with us, you know. And it was at the time that, you know, mixed race couples were, you know, not as usual as they are now. My father's from Barbados, my mother's English. And, you know, it made for an environment where I was aware very early of some of the issues that surround that. I became aware very early of the nature of racism and the inequality in the sense of the way that my father was treated compared to my mother when we went on holiday, particularly when we left London. Really? So we often used to go to Devon and Cornwall on holiday. Mm-hmm. And we would sort of freestyle it, get down there and go to bed and breakfasts and things. And it was just the rule that when my dad got out and asked if there were any rooms, there were never rooms. But when my mum did, there were rooms.
That's appalling.
Yeah, and it was just the thing. And occasionally my mum would go, oh, you go. No, sorry, there aren't any rooms. Then my mum would go back, oh, yes, there's rooms. And then sheepishly we'd all sort of go up to the front gate and the owner would realise what they'd done. And that kind of thing was just sort of very much a part of... my childhood, and also growing up in London and feeling, you know, slightly, you know, that we were slightly different from other families. You know, when I got to secondary school, my parents moved us out towards Essex for a bit more space. And, you know, at that stage, then we were really, you know, bar one other family, you know, the only family of with any ethnicity. And you know, you stand out, you become...
Yeah, it's interesting because we live in Kent, and my husband's half Chinese. You know, my gran said things like, well, people must notice Chris in the village. And I was like, why? But actually my eldest daughter looks more like her father, And when I was when she was little, people didn't think she was my daughter.
Yeah.
But in London, it was fine. When we went to visit friends in London, people would say, "Oh, what mix is she, or what nationality, what ethnicity is she, or whatever." But out here, people just thought she wasn't my daughter because I'm fair and she's not.
Yeah, and they just don't have experience of mixed race couples, so they don't know what people look like.
But yeah, that must have been quite dramatic though, because I know my husband moved from England to Scotland, and being very, and it was sort of a remote area of Scotland as well, and being a Chinese looking guy with an English accent, he had a really hard time.
Yeah.
I think people don't quite realise the impact of, once you move out of London,
yeah,
or Birmingham or Manchester or any of the cities, people... I expect they're more accepting now, but I mean, I'm talking about my daughter who is only 13, so it's not that long ago.
Yeah. I think it's, and sometimes you just don't want to feel like the odd one out. So, you don't want to have to be the person that sticks out. You just want to be the one that is the same as everybody else when you're a child, but having a different identity means that you do. And so, you are aware of certain things that maybe that you wouldn't be otherwise. So I suppose, my dad always was, there were always lots of newspapers around and everything. So I got into reading newspapers and all of that sort of thing very early. And I suppose it was at university I started thinking about journalism.
What did you study at uni?
I studied English.
Purple.
And I sort of, the thing is, it's strange, but I got a job in a pub when I was there, and it was actually listening to people's stories that made me think I wanted to be a journalist rather than coming from the creative writing background. I just love listening to people's stories. And I realized when I was at university that I've always been the person that everybody comes to for advice, and because I listen. And I can write, and I love listening to stories. I can be a therapist, or I can be a writer. And that was when it first struck me that I wanted to do it. It seemed to sort of tie in with all my passions, and the sense of, I really wanted to give people a voice that didn't have a voice, because when I was growing up, there weren't many people that looked like me in the media. And I wanted to maybe sort of tell the stories that I hadn't read, and also tell other people's stories that are marginalized. So I suppose that's a lot of where it came from.
Well, I think it's fascinating as well when you say you're taking in families who are moving in from South Africa, which shows that your family is clearly very open-minded, open-hearted. And that will have given you exposure to a whole load of different viewpoints and experiences that a typical child living in London just wouldn't get. Because you're seeing people coming from a different country who have been who've been under apartheid in that country. And I mean, I know, again, referring to my mother-in-law, who's Chinese, grew up in South Africa under apartheid, and I just love talking to her about the experiences and her perspective and her views. And I mean, I'm a big fan of Nelson Mandela. She doesn't like Nelson Mandela, but I love the complexity of viewpoints. But you were getting that really early on in life. You were getting that before you even went to university. Mm. And so you pieced all these things together. Sounds like you had a lot of self-awareness as well to understand what made your heart sing, because a lot of people struggle to find that until later on in life.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly didn't know the route that I would choose to get there, but I just knew that I wanted to do something in that world of journalism. I mean, I left university and struggled, went into book publishing for a bit, which was interesting, but it was just far too slow. And then I suppose I kind of, I sent off 100 begging letters to various magazines to try and get work experience, and managed to get some work experience, and it went from there, really. But I think I, although I worked at a couple of magazines before I went to newspapers. I did spend almost 5 years at the Daily Mail, which I think was quite formative in terms of my training, because being on a daily, somewhere so fast paced and somewhere that didn't actually represent the values that I would say were mine, but somewhere that the training really was excellent, and it allowed me to travel. And it was at a time when they were really they were putting money into investigative journalism, and I was a bit different, and I was doing stories that, you know, that I could, I was doing everything from, you know, smuggling myself into the Cannes Film Festival and trying to get a role in a movie as an actress to expose the casting couch and Harvey Weinstein and
that. Oh, wow.
And that was sort of going back 15 years now. Wow. You know, exposing some really awful stuff in Russia around stem cells, really? The use of stem cells from aborted fetuses. And so, so I got to do some incredible things there, and thankfully didn't have to work on the domestic stories around things like immigration or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I did some really exciting work.
You must have been pretty young when you're doing that as well.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I was. I was in my 20s, and I was able to travel freely, and I had no ties, and I had no sense of fear whatsoever. So I did a lot of undercover work, and there weren't many women prepared to do undercover work, and I just literally was missing a danger gene. So I put myself in all sorts of ridiculous situations, and I was only caught once when I was exposing one of Donald Trump's business and that was but I did go undercover many, many times, and on the back of that managed to get some work for Channel 4 doing undercover reporting for them. I went to India to look at the sweatshops making clothes for British High Street that were using children. And so a lot of the stories that I did were based on investigating unethical practices, business dealings that were, you know, were a bit murky, but also, you know, looking at the way women were exploited, you know, by powerful men, how that could happen.
I love that you did all that. It's really funny because on another podcast I was talking to someone, and he was sort of talking about traveling around, and he likes to go to places just after there's been a conflict because he says there's no one else there. And actually in that I said I always wanted to be one of those journalists that went to war zones. What's that lady in the BBC?
Kate Ady.
Yes, I loved Kate Ady.
She's amazing. I think that's Kate Ady is the reason why most women went into journalism.
Really? I mean, that's not amazing from the role model perspective. You see it, you see someone doing it, and you think, I'd love to do that. It was something I always thought I would love to do. So I'm particularly excited by what you're saying. And I love those stories. And I love Weinstein. Well, no, I don't love Weinstein. I love that you were exposing the Weinsteins and the Trumps. And
I tell you the Weinstein story. I mean, I did that story and about the casting couch and all the disgusting things that I experienced firsthand when I was pretending that I was an actress trying to get into a movie in Cannes. I met Weinstein. I went to those parties. Oh, cool. I could see everything. And I wrote it into that story. And the funny thing is, 15 years ago, it was a story, but it was like, it was not, people were like, oh yeah, God, yeah, it's terrible, but that stuff goes on. There was an acceptance. And I think it's really interesting what's happened with Me Too, because it's a generation of women who have grown up, or have the generation behind, who have got to a place of power and saying, actually, yes, we know this has always happened, but it's definitely not okay. Yeah. We need to do something about it. Because I think people knew these stories were always there, but there wasn't the appetite. The timing wasn't right for this stuff to come out. It's not like it wasn't in the press what he'd been doing or what men like him were doing, and these sort of practices and these parties where girls were picked up and promised these sort of things. And, you know, I must have done 3 or 4 of those stories. So I went to Cannes every year, and I exposed those sort of things. It's just the timing was right for it to become bigger.
That's amazing. And I think what's amazing as well is hearing from someone who you know that you've got a true story. It's you went in without bias. You went in to find out. It was investigative. And it was 15 years ago. So it's not someone now saying, oh, this is how it was and it shouldn't have been, but maybe it wasn't quite like that and we're not 100% sure. You were there, you saw it.
Yeah, I did, yeah. And it's very, very real. And it wasn't just in the acting world. There were sportsmen, there were just entrepreneurs doing it. It was extremely prevalent. And it probably still is, you know.
I
think the difference now is social media. Because back then, I was one of the few people that had a BlackBerry. But people weren't carrying around phones with cameras. So the parties that you could get into, there was not the places that you could get to if you're a young woman in the right clothes. You could find yourself in the most incredible room with the most powerful men in the industry. And they would let you in because they wouldn't know I was a journalist, obviously, but they weren't expecting you to pull out a camera.
Yeah.
For example. Whereas now the defences are up because obviously any of those moments can be recorded at any time. Mm-hmm. And so people are a bit more on their guard.
It's amazing, isn't it? That shift is, I mean, that's a positive of social media. I often sort of dwell on the negative of social media, but that's such a positive because it's enabling more equality.
And and the galvanization of people. I mean, that's I think what it is. It's like that all of those voices were out there, the Me Too women, all completely isolated, telling their little groups of friends. But social media has enabled women to group together and express that as a collective voice across nations, which is really powerful.
Incredibly powerful. Incredibly powerful. So it's the fact that you were there, the fact that you experienced that, that must have just heightened your hunger to represent women, to represent feminism, all those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been fiercely feminist anyway. But I suppose seeing that sort of thing, you do want to right wrongs and expose that kind of those sort of people. After the Mail, I went to Channel 4 and I went to Grazia in between that, and ended up at Marie Claire, where you know, there was this huge focus on women's empowerment, and I'd never been at a publication like that before. It was always a case of, you know, you wanted to do those stories, but you could only do one amongst everything else. And then getting to Marie Claire and being responsible, I was features director and having to produce sort of 8 or 9 features and being able to sort of get into some of those topics. As well as the lighter entertaining stuff, which is brilliant, but also just being able to get into those meaty topics and commission brilliant journalists to go out and cover them.
It must have been
fantastic.
Pretty good, yeah. Particularly, I think when it's really hard working in any organisation when it doesn't align with your values, and I think you're expressing your values through the work you were doing, Daily Mail, but it's being in an environment that actually aligns with your values enables you to flourish, doesn't it? Because you can go, hang on a minute, it's not just one story. Like you say, I can now do 8 features on that, or I can do this. And so, it's interesting you say the stories, the issues haven't changed. I mean, the angle on the issue has changed we're seeing more women on boards, we're seeing more exposure through Me Too. What do you feel is, what are the burning topics at the moment?
Well, I mean, for me, I'm at the moment thinking very much in the present of lockdown. Yep. And so for me, the real burning topic is, when we finally emerge from this, what will be the fallout on women? Mm. And how will women's lives be impacted? Certainly from what I see around me anecdotally and from what people tell me, you know, who I network with on social media, women are picking up the brunt of what's going on domestically at the moment, and also struggling to hold on to jobs that are being affected by the crisis. Women are predominantly in this sort of hospitality fields. They are, you know, in the care professions. And so I think this whole situation is going to set women back, and the women and women's equality back years. Yeah. And so that's, I think, a really burning topic, and how we address that, as well as something a bit wider, like climate change, you know, and some of the good stuff that's happened during lockdown. You know, how can we hold on to some of that stuff and take some of the positive changes into our lives as we move forward, you know, and leave some of the negative stuff we were doing behind? I mean, do we want to go back to normal, in inverted marks? I mean, do we want to? Do we want to create a new normal that means that maybe we are flying less and that we are rewarding companies for more sustainable practices, and rewarding companies that do that are nicer to their workers and allow women to work from home and more flexibly? You know, so I think some of that stuff is, you know, really core to the values that we've always championed in Marie Claire, but really now are at the absolute center of the next stage of our development globally. Those are sort of issues that we're going to be getting into in Marie Claire over the coming weeks and months.
I think it's again, it comes back to being a trusted brand and an essential mouthpiece, as it were, for those issues. Because otherwise they're the sort of things that there's a tendency for women as a gender to, when a crisis hits, is to get on with stuff. And so it won't be making a big scene or shouting about it, and their voices do need to be heard. And, you know, in a similar way that it's not officially the case, but, you know, there's some things come out about the countries that have fared best in the world are the ones with female leaders. And from the perspective of what I do, which is analysing leaders, is the women have carried on in a very calm way. They've been very clear. They haven't made a song and a dance about it. And that's a huge generalisation, I realise. But I guess a concern for me from some of the work I've been doing looking at people around the world is how it's going to hit disadvantaged populations as well.
Yeah, I mean,
that's obviously, it forces inequality further from both sort of the economic perspective, but also females in disadvantaged populations. It really worries me.
Yeah, I mean, we have a series at the moment called COVID Diaries, and it features the first person stories of women all over the world and how they're dealing with COVID. And, you know, some of them are, you know, 42 guests at my wedding were infected with COVID, or, you know, and that sort of thing. And we just got one in from Zimbabwe yesterday, and it was a woman saying, "We haven't even got running water, let alone soap. So I can't protect my family."
Oh my God.
And it's just a whole different.
And that, I think that's really important. And this is just my view, but I've been watching the news. It was actually this morning I was watching the news, and I was thinking, all the humanitarian issues haven't disappeared. Mm. You know, the issues in war zones haven't disappeared. We're just not hearing about it now because all the focus is on COVID, and it's understandably on that, but there's me thinking we still need these things to be heard, because when it hits Africa, when it hits areas in Asia, it is going to just wipe out populations, as well as having a huge economic impact, and then having an impact like that where people don't even have running water. I was lucky, I went to Zambia a couple of years ago, and I met some amazing people, but they're living in conditions that we just wouldn't even fathom in the UK. And I think it's so easy to sort of see it as something that's over there, and it's something that, because it's not in our face, we forget about it. But equally, you know, there are underprivileged populations in London, in Birmingham, and all this.
Absolutely. I mean, there's the shocking statistics about how ethnic minorities in this country have been hit by COVID are really difficult reading, you know, and there's just got to be an investigation about that.
I agree. And I think it's my personal view again, I think that's only come out because of the things that were coming out of the US. Mm. And I think where we were seeing how it was hitting ethnic minorities in the US, or African Americans in particular, who have to go to work, who don't have health insurance. I think that story then moved back to the UK, where we started thinking, actually, is there something going on here with this as well? Can we look at the data around it here? And clearly there is. Mm. And so these are all massive things to think about. And Marie Claire is an amazing platform to be able to investigate and express. I mean, it's be able to express the viewpoint of someone from Zimbabwe. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's not just saying, hey, this is what's happening in London. This is what's happening in... Because a lot of media can be very London-centric as well.
I think that was sometimes the problem at other publications I've worked for. They just didn't have that global view. It always had to be quite domestic.
It's not even countrywide view, is it? It tends to be
London-centric. Yeah. But being able to look at this crisis through the prism of women's experience in, you know, global territories it's great. And to be able to give those people a voice, you know, it's...
And I think, again, it's like if you come back to the point of how you've discussed social media giving a collective voice to Me Too movement, and hopefully the difference between this crisis and other crises, global crises that happened in the past, is that there's an opportunity to give these people a voice and make it more collective. Mm. So the rest of the world does actually have to listen. Mm. Who knows? I mean, who knows how it's all going to pan out.
Absolutely.
So in terms of Marie Claire itself, you, your job, what are you loving most at the moment? And so it is a massive role to have taken on. What does that make you feel? Do you feel slightly like, oh God, it's a bit overwhelming? Do you feel excited? Do you feel proud? What?
Sometimes it can feel overwhelming. But I think I'm through that now. I think I was a little bit overwhelmed at the beginning because I just felt like there was so much to do and so much to cover. But early on, I sort of established four content pillars, which are the values that I really care about and that I felt that all of the content could be mapped under. And that's women's empowerment, sustainability, education of women and girls, and good mental health. And so, you know, on a daily and weekly basis, I'm just sort of coming back to that and thinking, you know, is the beauty content that we're doing about asking women to change, or is it about the idea that, you know, women are enough as they are, and we're just empowering them with some tools to make them feel good about themselves? You know, is the fashion about fast fashion, or is it about, you know, we all absolutely love clothes and we love going shopping, but just thinking a little bit more about the purchase decisions that you make and brands that you have to make them sustainable. You know, is our content offering responsible messaging and educating women in a positive way about how they can change the world? And is it reskilling and upskilling them for the future? Because we are actually, you know, I see Marie Claire is about informing women. So that sort of very much ties into our education. And then the women's empowerment, which really is the most important one for me. And that's about making women feel uplifted when they read it, but also shining a spotlight on the stories of other women and helping to empower them as well. So that those positive messages of strengthening women and creating change embodies everything that we do. I mean, really, it's about going, you know, finishing every week and thinking, have I partnered with somebody this week that could have brought about some positive change? Yeah, and also about creating content that just makes people feel a little bit better about things as well, because it's not all, it doesn't all have to be the serious sort of changing the world stuff. It can just be stuff that makes you feel a bit better about getting up out of bed and feeling like you can take on the day and take on the world, and particularly in this situation, even just be a good parent, really.
Yeah, I think that's something that we're all struggling with at the moment. Because it's hard for everyone, but it's this sort of this strange situation where I think we feel, a lot of us sit at home feeling privileged to have a home, to have a family, to be together on the one hand, whilst feeling really fed up on the other. And I think, you know, that's another message, I'm sure, is like, it's okay to feel like you're fed up with stuff. But I think what's nice as well is when you're telling stories about people that are living a different life, it's not necessarily that it's the serious stuff, but it's the stuff that gives people a sense of perspective, because you can read it and you think, wow, my God, actually, it's not so bad if, you know, I had a bit of an argument this morning with someone in my family, or it's not so bad that my hours have been reduced, I'm not homeless.
Exactly.
And so I think there's positivity in that as well, and it's that feeling of inspiration partly, isn't it? And I know I used to find that when I was younger and I read Marie Claire, it was always seeing those stories, they are inspiring, seeing someone's different perspective. But I think it comes back to what you're saying, when you worked in the pub and you're hearing lots of different people's stories, everyone wants to do that. That's who we are as humans. We want to understand what other people are going through. That helps us make sense of our own world. And it helps us make us feel like we're part of a human community, which when you're stuck in a room or a flat on your own, which some people are, you need more than ever at the moment.
Absolutely. And I think it's also about drawing strength from people's parallel stories to yours. So, you know, one of the things that we've done during lockdown is really talk about the huge soaring domestic violence, you know, just how prevalent that is in really normal lives, normal people's lives, and how, you know, we've had some brilliant people come out and that you would never really imagine would be, I mean, I don't know what people think of the type of person. There is no type.
I think there is a sort of, there's a slight stereotype in that you think it's someone who's downtrodden and who lives in a certain...
Yeah, and it's just not. And so if by showing that again and again and again through strong, beautiful, intelligent women's stories and say, look, it even happened to this person, you can reach out to a woman who's on that journey and encourage her to get help. That's a really wonderful privilege to have as a journalist and as an editor.
Well it's been amazing to hear some of your story, Andrea, and I mean, I love talking to you always, but it's a privilege to share it on this platform as well. And I'm sure you will have inspired people today who are listening. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I absolutely loved speaking with Andrea for this episode. I hope you'll have found inspiration in her passion and feel as motivated as I do every time I speak to her to go and do my bit in making the world a better place. Thanks so much for listening.